Access number 28654, it's Leslie Gilbert, Reel 3. Now, I think we've now reached the point where we actually ask you, what was this radar equipment that you were being trained on? I don't know whether you know the numbers and details.
Well, this particular equipment was called ASV, Air to Surface. I don't know what the V stood for now. But anyway, it was equipment fitted into aircraft to pick up surface vessels. That's right, air-to-surface vessels to pick up ships or submarines on the surface. It worked, the frequency was 176 megacycles. The transmitter had klystrons with Lecker bars. The receiver was quite interesting because I believe that it was the same circuitry that was used in the initial BBC television transmissions, the 405 line television, which had begun to be broadcast, I think, in 1937 from Alexandra Palace. And there were two companies producing the receivers, Echo and Pi. And we had both types of receivers, and we used to call them the Echo and the Pi. And I believe that this was a bit of a dodge to deceive the Germans, that the factories were set up actually to churn this stuff out for the forces, but the idea was that it was going into civilian television sets. So we were very specifically trained on this equipment. The receivers, of course, had valves. There were no transistors.
Now, how did they work? How did an ASV work? What did it look like? Oh, because I'm not sure. And how did it work? Remember, they can't see anything, so they'll have
to. Yes, I know. I just wondered if I had a photograph to show you. Well, I worked eventually on Wellington aircraft. Now, there was an aerial under each wing, which looked rather like the old-fashioned television aerials that some of us would be used to now. Not the modern 625 line, but the older ones. There was one under each wing, pointing slightly outwards from dead ahead. That was to discover if anything that was ahead. Then on the upper part of the plane itself, there was a series of vertical rods with horizontal dipoles attached to them. All the transmission was horizontally polarized, and so the dipoles were all horizontal. In operation, the radar operator in the aircraft would either switch to a head transmission or sideways transmission, having to switch separately the transmitter and the receiver. And there's a story there, because later on, when I was overseas,
and we'll come to that.
All right. Yes.
Now, how did it work? I mean,
a pulse of radio waves would be sent out, a very short pulse of radio waves. Then if they struck anything, then there'd be a reflected beam of radio, which would be picked up by the receiver. That was then put onto a cathode ray oscilloscope type screen, a round screen only about 9 inches in diameter. It had a vertical trace on it. Imagine a single green line vertically in the middle of the screen. If something was picked up by one of the aerials, that would produce a horizontal blip, as it was called, on one side or the other of the vertical trace. If, for example, the aircraft picked up a ship dead ahead, then you get two equal size blips. If the ship you picked up was more to starboard than to port, then the starboard blip would show up more than the port one. How far the blip was from the start of the bottom of the vertical trace indicated how far away the target was. So you could read off from the screen immediately the distance of the target and where it was in relation to the heading of the aircraft. The radar operator could then tell the pilot left, left, or right, right. I suppose they said port or starboard because, yeah, until the two blips were equal. And that was fairly effective.
Now, how did you train on this on the ground? That's how it would be fitted to a Wellington. Yeah. You had what were you learning on the ground?
You're learning how it worked. You never, as far as I can, I suppose one did operate it because you could use it on the ground, as we did in real circumstances sometimes, to detect aircraft up in the sky. Although it was called air to surface, you could also obviously get a reflection off a plane that was flying around.
So you were learning how to operate, how to generate the pulse.
Not how to operate, how to service, maintain.
Now, how did you service and maintain it? What did that entail?
Finding out what was wrong with it and putting it right.
And what were the sort of things that were that it was prone to? Or in the training we're talking about, I don't want you to move too much.
No. Well, like any electronic equipment, valve failure or failure of one of the components, a resistor, a capacitor, a choke, or something mechanical like one of the switches that you used in order to switch from one direction to another direction. The equipment one used was what was called an avometer, which was something that measured voltage, current, and resistance. An oscilloscope and a very important device and very heavy, portable but very heavy, to measure the frequency of the transmitter, which had to be set fairly closely.
So you were learning how to use all this diagnostic equipment.
Right.
And then presumably to repair any faults that you then found.
Yes, that's it. There was no business in those days of saying, oh, well, it's one of the circuit boards gone, we'll pull that out, put another one in, throw the old one away. You had to find out what was wrong and replace that particular component.
And so you I've not heard of an avometer till yesterday, funnily enough.
It's a lovely multi-purpose meter, quite a large thing.
And you'd use all of these. You know, basically, with those you could generally determine why something had stopped working.
Yeah, you jolly well had to. There was nowhere you could fall back on. If you didn't put it right, then, there'd be real trouble.
And I presume you learned how to maintain the spares, so you'd keep a variety of valves and...
Valves, yes. Resistors, capacitors, all the various run-of-the-mill components. You had to learn how to solder, I mean, most of this, once again, I could do because I used to build my own radios, but of course I didn't know until I went to Cranwell how the radar worked, really worked.
Now, how secret was it? Was it impressed upon you that you mustn't tell people about it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And one realised the importance of it. I don't think I ever told anybody about it. I mean, I took this kind of thing quite seriously, you know.
And was there any question of were you still a member of the Communist Party? You're not supposed to be in the services, but people were.
Well, I hadn't left it, but I had no involvement.
And you certainly didn't tell anybody.
Well, I didn't tell anybody, no.
Yeah, but you didn't tell anybody in the Communist Party about the radar either.
Oh, no.
So you basically just behaved as a good RAF chap and didn't sort of go beyond that.
In fact, I actually used to think sometimes, what would happen if a Soviet agent somehow got on to me and wanted to know something from me that I could tell him? And I remember thinking, I wouldn't. It was just not the right thing to do.
Now, anything else you were learning on these shifts on the ASV?
No.
Any other equipment other than the air? Any other types
of
set?
No, it was highly specialised.
You were ASV.
That's
that
right,
was your
just
thing.
On that thing, yeah, which led to problems later on.
And how long was the course going on for?
I think this was 3 months. I think I've got it the right way round, that the initial training was 6 and then the specialist was 3. And there was an exam at the end. And now we were all aircraftsmen. Our grade was AC1, I think. And we knew that the top one or two people in the exam would be made up to LAC, leading aircraftsmen. But while we were on the course, we were told that that was being dropped. And regardless of our performance, we would all come out as AC1.
Aircraftman first class.
Yes.
That was going to be it.
Yeah. There was somebody, it was fairly obvious I was going to be at or near the top. And there was one other chap also who I knew. And we told the NCO in charge that in view of this new rule, we were going to do badly in the exam. And we were told, well, it's okay, if you do well enough, we'll make you LAC. And I was made an LAC. So, I mean, it was a strange kind of atmosphere there. You see, it was... this went throughout my experience as a radar mechanic. We were a kind of group apart. On operational squadrons, we were called the Goons.
Yeah, well, we will come to that. Now, so you qualified. Now, when would this be? Now, if it was, it sounds like about January 1942 to me, but would you be able to put a date on it?
Not more accurately, no. No.
Would it be 42?
Probably, yes.
Okay, and what happened then?
Then I had my first posting, and I was posted, and looking back, I realised this was because of my performance on the course, the exam. I was posted to the Coastal Command Development Unit, CCDU, which at that time was based in South Wales.
Whereabouts?
At Carew Cheriton, which is a little way west of Tenby.
You wouldn't know how to spell that.
Yes, Carew Cheriton. That was what you might call an operational research unit. It had a variety of aircraft, and the boffins, the backroom boys doing their research at Malvern or wherever, would send stuff down to be fitted into aircraft and to be tested.
Now, you were a leading aircraftman, radar mechanic or technician?
Yes, the radar mechanic we were called. These days it would be called a technician.
And what was your reception when you got there? What was the size of the unit? What was it made up of? Or your section of it, anyway?
Well, there weren't many radar mechanics there because what was being tested was not only radar. So there was only a very small number of radar mechanics. And there was a squadron leader in charge of the radar unit, such as it was. He was clearly a very bright graduate who'd been put in charge of this research work. He enjoyed doing the testing of the equipment in the workshop at some crazy time in the evening, and he wanted me there with him. And I remember he used to smoke a curved pipe and say, put some umpa music on the wireless, will you? And we used to work together there, not as squadron leader and LAC, but as two people working on equipment. We were there for only a short while.
What sort of equipment? I mean, do you remember any of the experimental equipment you're on? Because it's obviously quite interesting, the one reason.
Well, I mean, there was the ASV. There were other things being tested. One that I remember in particular, I think it was called a Lee light. It sounded like a crazy idea, but it was a searchlight the size of a large dustbin that was to be fitted in the underside of an aircraft so that it was up inside the aircraft. But then if the aircraft was on patrol and thought it had detected, for example, a submarine, the searchlight would be lowered so that the beam could be shone ahead and the target could be illuminated. I thought it was quite crazy, but apparently it did lead to a number of successes.
Now, why did you think it was crazy?
To stick the dustbin underneath the aircraft and the searchlight, I mean, what, you know, it doesn't sound... not the kind of thing I would have thought of would work.
What else were they working on there? Any other radar stuff, or was it just the ASB?
Well, this wasn't radar, this Leeland thing.
Oh, I know. So, I mean, was there any other radar stuff other than the ASV?
Not that I know of, no.
So they were checking the ASV, and then this is a Leeland searchlight, ridiculous thing. Anything else you remember there?
No, because I think, you see, there were obviously various little groups testing various little things, and I didn't know what they were up to. And I don't know that we would have wanted to talk to one another.
There was secrecy even between different elements.
I think
so. And where were you living? What was your what was your living conditions like there?
I think I was just living in a hut with 20 other men. I think there were 21 per hut. I remember virtually nothing about it. Used to get a fair amount of leave. It was quite a business getting up to London because you could only get a train, I think, from Swansea, so it was a matter of hitchhiking into Swansea as best you could, and then the train up to London. There wasn't much traffic on the road, but of course in those days, if you were in uniform, most people would stop for you.
Now, anything you remember about your time there?
The only thing I remember about the time there, apart from what I've told you, was that we were then to be moved to Northern Ireland, and a lot of the gear was loaded up in aircraft to be flown there. And one of the Wellingtons was loaded up and I think was overloaded. And so when it took off, it stalled and crashed down into some houses. And what happened to the people, I don't know.
Did you see the accident?
No.
You just heard about it?
Yes. And we flew over, I was flown, I think, I'm not sure, to the famous Ballykelly in Northern Ireland.
Same unit, but...
Yes, CCDU again, yes.
What was the same work there then?
Yes. But much less pleasant, because it seemed to rain all the time. We were in huts. The mud was more or less up to our knees. There was an occasion, and we were on the banks of Lough Foyle, and I became friendly with a Canadian radar mechanic from, I think, Winnipeg, who was a real outdoor chap, and he used to take me duck shooting, never shot any ducks. He, incidentally, until he'd come over to this country, had never tasted sea fish. In those days, being inland and with very little refrigeration, they only had freshwater fish. One incident I recollect there was with a bow fighter. They went up to test some equipment or other that involved chucking out something which had on the end of a parachute. Not a man on the end of a parachute, some large weight for some reason. On the end of a parachute, they threw this out of the bow fighter. The parachute wrapped itself around the tail of the aircraft, which then became uncontrollable. And we watched it spiraling down till it hit the ground and burst into flames. And still, you know, I talked about sand in the road. Well, similarly, whenever I see a great plume of black smoke, I think of this aircraft burning. And the crew were given a formal burial. We had to march along the road with the bier to the church. Slow march. I recollect that quite clearly. I also remember going up into the hills with a chap. That it turned out there were peat bogs there, digging the peat, and we walked for miles and miles until we came to a village, and then we had to get back again, and of course we were worn out. And it turned out there was a bus terminus there, bus about two times a day, going into Londonderry, from which we could get another bus back to the camp. The bus was actually there. We asked when it was going, or we asked where we could get some food, and they said, you go to Mrs. So-and-so, she'll fix you up. We asked when the bus was going, and it was going in about 10 minutes. And we said, oh dear, and the crew said, that's all right, we'll wait for you. That was Ireland for you. we went to Mrs. So-and-so. We had the kind of meal you'd never get in civilian life at that time. Steak and eggs and goodness knows what. I began to hear some of the Irish business going on there, but I didn't know what it was about. On the buses, people used to sing a song about the bloody hand. And I think that was the ultra-loyalists. Bloody hand.
The Red Hand of Ulster.
Yeah. Oh, that would be it, yes. Yes.
Were you aware of Ulster politics, of Irish politics?
No, as I said, I heard this song, but I probably even joined in, had not the slightest idea what it was about. And that, don't forget, this was Londonderry that was our main town. But we were curiously isolated from what went on.
And anything happened while you were there? Anything you remember other than that?
I don't think so.
How long were you there for, Ballykenny?
Well, I'd have to start working back then, because I know the next place I'm going to mention, I was there until July 42, and we're up to about when now?
Well, you seem to have gone to Carrickcheriton about January 42.
Yeah, I don't think we were there long, so let's say, I think probably a couple of months at Carrickcheriton, a couple of months at Ballykelly, and then the next place.
Now, what the next place was?
Tain, T-A-I-N, in northeast Scotland.
T-A-I-N. Whereabouts in northeast Scotland?
Very, very far up, not far from the top of Scotland. And when I used to come down to London, mind you, there was a lot of business with the trains in those days. I mean, so much troop trains and armaments and whatnot. On one occasion, it took 24 hours to come down to London.
Who were you? Were you joining a new unit there, or was this
same unit?
The coastal development unit.
Yeah, they were clearly shunting us around to wherever nobody else wanted to be. You see, it didn't really matter what airfield we were on. Oh, going back to Ballykelly, there is something I remember there. I was detailed to test something called IFF. Now, IFF was really quite important. It's short for Identification Friend or Foe, because if you pick up a target on the radar, how do you know whether it's one of them or one of us? Well, if it's one of us, the IFF transmits a coded signal, which I think was changed every day. And I had to test a new mark of IFF. So
this wasn't the first version, but it was a version.
A version, yeah. So the whole event was laid on so that I could take certain readings. And the way it was laid on was that there was a destroyer out off the coast. And I was put into, I think it was a bow fighter, with this IFF. And the pilot had to fly 20 miles away from the destroyer in one direction, fly straight to the destroyer and 20 miles past, go up 1,000 feet and back, up another 1,000 feet and back, and so on. I was sitting there with this equipment, with earphones on, noting the various signals and having to write things down. I'm a bad flyer and a bad sailor, and there was no window. And the pilots on this kind of unit were being rested from real operations, but they were young men and they enjoyed themselves. So we started off and we flew across the destroyer, nice and level, to 20 miles the other side. Then he had to turn, so woof, as sharp as he could, and climb up madly to the next height, and then to the end of that, and then woof, back again, and so on. And I got more and more ill, and eventually I was sick all over the stuff, but I thought, I've got to keep on. I mean, the whole thing's been laid on so that LAC Gilbert can take these readings. And so I went on with it. Eventually came down, what the ground crew said about all the vomit they're talking about. And I took away all these sodden bits of paper and transcribed them. I'd done my job.
And it worked. And it worked. Yeah. This IFF.
I don't know what they were up to, but they never told me. They just told me what readings I had to take. But that went on, by the way, all the time. These the kinds of units I was on were the aircrew were being rested, and they objected to driving buses, as it were. So.
And any other things? I mean, you tested the IFF. Any other things that might have slipped your mind that you were testing? Any new stuff?
No, not there. No.
And then, so Tain as well. Tain's just more of the same.
I was there for really a very short time. My main memory is that it was summer, it was dry, and it hardly got dark at all. And when I went swimming, I regretted I'd done it because the sea was so cold.
Now, what was, so pretty well that then. Now, is the next move with the CCDU?
No, because while I was on CCDU, that's one of the points, I'm not sure which, I volunteered to go overseas.
Now, why did you volunteer for overseas service? Because that's dangerous, there's no two ways about it. You know, you can get somewhere where you very easily get yourself killed. Yeah. What made you do it?
I wanted the experience. I should have stayed at CCDU, and I think I would have, you know, I would have got on very well there in research work. These days, now, looking back, I wonder. On the other hand, as you'll discover as I go on, I had a remarkable range of experiences overseas, which, in a way, I would never have missed. The most kind of intense period of my life.
So you were sort of looking for just more excitement, more involvement in the war.
Not in the war. I wasn't thinking, no, that's where the action is, so much as it's going to be interesting.
So it's just to get the new experiences.
Yes.
Now, how long did it take from volunteering to when you were moved, posted?
I don't remember.
Well, when were you posted? Is that July that you were posted?
Yes. I was, first of all, posted to somewhere in the Midlands, to be sent overseas, and then that trip was cancelled, so I was sent back to Tain again. But then shortly afterwards, I was posted to Manchester to be organised for going overseas.
And you don't know where in Manchester or what the unit was?
It was at Wilmslow, one of the suburbs.
And what were you doing there? Just preparing? How did they prepare you?
Overseas kit. Complete with pith helmet and shorts, so we knew.
What did you think of the kit you got, the overseas, the tropical kit?
Well, I like the shorts and the shirts, but the pith helmet was a joke. And very shortly after we got overseas, they simply disappeared altogether. I don't remember anyone ever wearing a pith helmet.
And what about? Did you get your vaccinations?
Oh
there?
yes, a pretty rough. I once reckoned that altogether in the Air Force I had something like 40 injections.
And did they have much? Some people react very badly. I don't mean fainting at the start. I mean actually physically react to the serum.
Yeah, well, there was one of them where when you had had it, you couldn't raise your arm above your elbow. It was made it extremely difficult to dress and undress. It was very, 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 very painful. I never had any other adverse reaction.
You didn't get flu-like symptoms or this?
I don't remember that, no.
And anything else happened while you were at Wilmslow? I presume you were just there a day or two or a week or two?
Just, I suppose, a week or so, yes. But there were people were obviously being mustered from all over the country, you see, and not only at Wilmslow, but other places as well.
And this is July, you think?
Yes.
And what happened?